What attracts you to, I guess, screenwriting as opposed to writing novels? I mean, if that is, if you don't write novels.
Yeah, I actually started when I got back into writing, which I did after I had my daughter. I was ready to poke my eyes out from Sesame Street. So I started a novel, and I'd always been a satirical writer. I mean, I love Jane Austen, but
Okay.
somehow it came out as more of a psychological thriller. And I wrote it, and I wasn't going to show it to anybody, but I let one friend read it, and she did theater, and she said, "Geez, I'd love to see it as a play or a script." And I actually wrote it as a challenge because I knew nothing about screenwriting, and I got one book, and the whole idea that you have to take this story and you only have a certain amount of time and you have a
Exactly.
certain, yeah, it's like it's such a
It
challenge, and I loved
is,
it. And you have to be really efficient, you know what I mean? You don't just say he ran across the room. You want to really emote through that word run and let the person
yes.
know what he was feeling. And it's awesome. You only have words. I just think it's the coolest thing. So yeah, I'm really
Yeah.
addicted to it. I think poetry is a really good comparison because you're getting the same feel you had. It's very compact, and it's very visual writing. And I got into a debate once with a writer, and they said, "Well, novel writing is very visual." I'm not so sure. I think with novel writing, there's so much internal stuff about the characters, which is why novels don't often translate to movies, because you're painting more emotion versus with poetry and with script, I think it is more visual, for me at least.
Yeah.
That's really what I'm looking for. But yeah, it's addictive. It's really addictive.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I would definitely agree because with a screenplay, not only do you have to, visually, well, at least the way you write, you have to have your reader visually see what you're talking about, but at the same time, get them to sense what the character is feeling. You
Right.
know, so it's the same thing with the visual and also at the same time on the emotional aspect of it, to get a reader to feel what the character is feeling without saying what they're feeling.
And I do that. I think that you've become a real screenwriter, whether or not you've been paid. It's when you're at a coffee shop and you know that sort of monologue that where you narrate what everybody's doing, and you find yourself like picking words you never would have picked before, Yes, I do that all the time. Nobody just pays for their coffee anymore. They slap their money on the counter,
It's so explosive,
Yes.
it has so much energy to it. Exactly. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
It's
So
a great
how
way to see the world, I think. It's just a wonderful way to see the world, and hopefully one of us will be able to get one of the stories up on the screen so everybody can
oh
share it.
yes, that is the plan. That is the goal. So when you did you find the transition hard from writing novels to writing screenplays? Like, was that difficult for you to, and like you said, in terms of being economic with your words?
Yeah, I think the first drafts that I did, the first, well, the story that I translated over was called Bad Girls. And the
Okay.
first several drafts I did of that were really hard because I actually did it, I signed up for an online course, which I don't even think they offer anymore. I think it was through Writer's Digest. And it was the first time they'd really done it. And it was really hard because I didn't understand what he was saying. I couldn't grasp
Okay.
it because I was really coming at it from more of a literary perspective. And so he would talk about these things about, well, but the midpoint and the catalyst of your story, we don't really talk about that in literature, We just don't. And so that was really, really hard. And then especially people now talk about the narrative is really tight on my scripts, and I think, oh, thank God, because when I first started, that was the major criticism. You're writing this like a novel. You're writing like a novel. And I just didn't understand that, you have to see the story. And I think I tell my friends it's like giving birth. It's really you can describe it to someone, but until you sit down, you know what I mean, and you literally try to do it, and you're like, God, this is nothing like what they said. So
Exactly, exactly.
it was hard. I would say that my first drafts, I mean, they were flowery, to put it nicely, is how I would describe them.
Oh yeah, because I mean, with myself, I found it's because it's so much of, you have to find that perfect medium with it, that perfect middle point to where, you're not saying too much, but you're saying just enough,
Yes.
and you know, trying to, like, you first type out, say, like, a block of text and say, like, it's five lines, and you're like, okay, how can I condense this to two lines? You know what I mean? But still have it, you know, have the same effect, the same emotion, you know, that it had if it had five lines in it, you know? So for me, I think for me that was kind of the hard part, was to just have to condense everything, you know?
Well, and then you've mastered, once you master the condensing, and then someone reads it, somebody who really knows what they're doing, and then they say, this is good. Now, where is your writer's voice? And you go, what?
Yeah, exactly. There's always something else. Always something else. But, I mean, I think that's the beauty of it, is that it's such an evolving art form that nobody knows it all. When and why did you start writing?
Well, I'd always been writing, but it really, when I came out of college, I went into college as an English lit major, and then a counselor wisely said there's no money in that, so I went into psychology, and I didn't last long in psychology one semester, because it was a little bit like, you know, some kids go to the magic show, and they absolutely want to know how the magic is done.
Yes.
And I never do. I want to just enjoy that you did that. And I
want
to wonder how you, like, I'm more interested in the magician. Like, dude, you are so cool. How did you do that? You know? So
yes.
I couldn't do it. I came out of psychology, and I was a little afraid of people, to be quite honest, because I suddenly knew all the things that could go wrong. It was really depressing. I draw a lot on that now as I flesh out characters. But, it actually kicked off a huge depression for me. And
really?
Yeah, so I had to leave. I was at UMass Amherst, and I had to leave. I went to UMass Boston, and I moved home for a while and started writing again. And then I opened my own marketing firm, did really well, and just got sick of that. And then I, you know, we had our daughter, and I was home with her and sort of looking for a new challenge. So that became it, writing again.
Great. So pretty much it's always been with you, in a sense?
Oh, yeah, I've always written in one way or another. I mean, well, you know, even the marketing I was still writing. I was just writing ad copy and coming up with campaigns.
Very true.
But it's all a form of expression, for sure.
Okay. So what do you like to write?
I really love to write smart comedy. I mean, I grew up watching Monty Python with my dad. So, I mean, I don't understand. I got into a debate once with somebody over the Farrelly brothers versus the Coen brothers, right?
Okay,
the Coen brothers can write something really dark, comically dark, in a movie that is not a comedy. But that brief moment, you know, I mean, there were some Javier Bardem moments in No Country for Old Men that were terrifyingly funny. I mean, there was something about them. That's what I love. I really love that. Farrelly brothers with, you know, the fart jokes and all that, it does nothing for me. It just doesn't.
Yeah.
The Monty Python, I mean, I forget, I want to say it was John Cleese, but I'm not sure. Someone said, you know, you have to be really smart to be this funny or be this stupid or something. There's a quote that I'm massacring.
Uh-huh.
I think that makes so much sense. I really, really do. Especially when you think about subjects that a lot of us are tackling to make them funny. I mean, it's...
Uh-huh.
Some things are just really hard to find the funny in, but it's there if you look for it.
Exactly. Being that you mentioned Monty Python, that brings me to one of my favorite scenes in, I forgot which movie it was. I think it was The Holy Grail, when I think John Cleese is the Black Knight. I forgot who the main character, but he's trying to fight the main character, and he cuts off his arm. He's like, oh, just a flesh wound. That cracks me up. And he's still trying to fight with no arms. It's so ridiculous. It's funny.
It is so funny. And yet, if you were to sit down with, like, a literary critic, you know, somebody who really knew what they were doing, you could really pick apart. There's a lot of heavy-duty theme stuff going on in Monty Python.
Yes.
You don't necessarily notice it because he's just cutting off his limbs, and it's hilarious. Yeah, I love it. I love it. Comedy is definitely something, you know, that I get. I just find people really funny. I think we're so fragile, and we think we're such hot stuff. And, you know, one of my favorite anecdotes was Sting. And somebody a few years ago was doing an interview with him, and they talked about, did you know when you wrote, you know, what is it, Every Breath You Take or whatever, that it would be such a huge hit. And he said, you know, people come up to me and say that was their wedding song. And he said, I tell them, you know, it's about a stalker, right? And I heard that and I went, what? And I went back and listened to it. And he's right. It's totally.
Wow.
It's not happy love, you know, but we want to make it happy. We just want to. And I just thought that was fabulous, the way he took those words. But the melody and the rest of it, they don't go together.
Exactly.
The best films, to me, that's the Coen brothers. They're sliding in this, you think you know what you're getting, but then they slide in this really complex element. It's just amazing.
Yeah.
I aspire to that someday.
Yeah, that I find that to be funny as well. I mean, just the way people interpret things, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Like with that, everybody, you know, I won't say everybody, but like you said, people had it as their wedding song. They're like, dude, wait a minute, that song's about a stalker. You know what I'm saying? So it's just funny how like an artist can create something with one thing in mind, and then once he sets it out into the world, everybody, you know, interprets it in a totally different way.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah, I think as script writers, it's particularly tricky because I know that at, you know, the level that I'm aspiring to now, as I'm talking to producers and directors and even actors now, they will read the script and they pull something out of it that is totally different from what the rest got, and something I didn't even see, you know, it's really fascinating what people find in the words. And it adds to the writing, I think. It makes me think, oh, I have to keep that in mind the next time I write the next one. I have to watch that. Yeah, it's very
Yeah, definitely. I mean, like I said, the art form, the craft of writing itself is just wonderful. How do you in a sense develop your projects?
I have a period of creativity usually in between projects. And I will take in as much information as possible. I just start reading, and that's usually when I start calling people, and I want to, because I'm basically a loner. But that's when, you know, I'll call, and I want to go out. I want to go see shows, and because something's coming. I don't know what it is. I'm not consciously aware of it, but, like, I just feel this, this need to do something. And then eventually something will just hit, an idea, and I can't sleep, and I know that's it. And and then I just start making notes. I'm a paper girl, so I love the composition notebooks that everybody hated from school. I love them. I have shelves full of them. And I sit down with my mechanical pencil and my pink cake eraser, and I start fleshing things out. But I'm very visual, so if you look at my notebooks, I have a notebook for each movie I started. They all start with flowcharts or, you know, family trees, or there's something visual that helps me. And then eventually I get into the outlining and the research, and I've learned I don't write anything, no drafts, nothing, until I really have the outline down. I have really, okay. that was a hard lesson to learn. I learned that too many times over and over, for sure.
I've gone through that as well. Just from writing novels and getting to a point to where, you know, I guess in the beginning I was really organic, so I just wrote. Hey, I got an idea, let me just write. Then of course I would get stuck because I didn't know what I was writing.
Right,
you know,
exactly.
I didn't know. I had no idea where I was going, so I get stuck. You know,
place, but where the hell am I?
Exactly. You know, and I get stuck. I toss it and start something else. And then after having a ton of unfinished stories, I said, okay, wait a minute, Jamal. You know, I have to come up with some kind of process so I can see something through to completion, you know.
Yes.
And within that process, I learned, like, just as you learned, I have to finish the outline so I know where I'm going, you know.
Yeah.
I to try to catch as many plot holes or pitfalls early, you know, so that way once I sit down to write, I can just write.
Yep.
Yeah.
I think what you just described also where, you know, that moment where you sat down and said, you know, I have things unfinished, I have to find a process. That's exactly what I was thinking a few years ago.
Uh-huh.
I sat down and I said, I need a process, because I sort of viewed it, maybe from the marketing experience, as, look, you got to have a portfolio and you have to have more than one product on the shelf that people want.
Yes.
So you're going to have to come up with a way to generate this stuff one after the other.
Exactly.
So, yeah, the outline, that was a really critical kind of. Now, do you start with Like, do you painstakingly write out your premise or your log line first, or do you just flesh that out as you go?
Well, generally, I brainstorm first, and I just write down just words that I associate with the story, you know, words or character traits and such. And then from there, generally, I come up with like a little story concept where I'll put down, you know, who the protagonist is, the antagonist, what the plot is, the twist, then the resolution. So, I mean, that's pretty much where I kind of flesh it out. To with like the basic overall story, you know, this is what this person wants. This person, you know, wants to stop him because of whatever, you know. Then this is the twist, and then this is how it all ends. Blah blah blah. And
right.
So from there, I kind of focus on developing the antagonist and the protagonist characters.
Okay.
Once I find out more about them, that kind of helps me. It helps me to flesh out what else can happen in the story. So after I develop those two characters, then I go to the outline. And after the outline, I develop the like the supporting characters. So I'm very systematic in it, because if I'm not, I'll never finish anything. So I've had to come up with something to help me through this. So, but yeah.
Yeah, you got to be organized. I totally agree with you, because I think, there are some writers that I talk to on Twitter, and they will – they get frustrated, and yet when I make a suggestion like, you know, hey, have you thought about, you know, kind of come up with a process, or
yes.
I'll just ask them, what are your steps? They don't have any. And well, I don't like to do that. I don't like to confine myself. And I think, okay, dude, you know, we're going to be having this conversation 10 years
a whole
from now.
Lot. Exactly. Exactly. And I don't really understand. I mean, even when I didn't have a process, I knew that there should be one. You know, I wasn't against it. I just didn't know any better. You know? But yeah, it's once again, I try to explain it to people. It's like, okay, you know, you pack your bags, you hop in your car, and you say, okay, I'm gonna drive to Florida, but you don't have a map. It's like, how are you gonna get there? You know, and you don't know how to get there. You know what I'm saying? It's like, okay, you're basically going to just drive around aimlessly.
That's
you know,
right.
hoping you get to your endpoint. You know, to
right.
me, that's what it is to write without any type of process or any type of map or outline. It's like, I don't know where I'm going.
Right. Yeah, I agree. That's exactly it.
Because I run into, you know, a lot of writers like that as well with that same problem. So what is the favorite aspect of writing for you? In terms of, like, is it the character development? Is it writing the dialogue?
I would say that it's really, it's actually the whole first draft. As much as I hate it, I really adore it because, you know, I have an outline where I've hit the major beats, but it's really, the first draft is really the laboratory. And, you know, I'll sit down and I'll say, okay, I know that this is what I have laid out on the outline, but, you know, this one sentence in my outline, but how do I want to see that happen? What do I want to see on the screen? And I just find that really fun because that's the point where the characters start talking for themselves. You know what I mean? And that's my favorite part. When I've written something and I'll think, whoa, you know, that did not come from me. You know, that is so awesome. And it's so cool because then that's that kind of effortless feel. You know, there's nothing effortless about it, but for that brief moment, it just feels like, oh, you've plugged into something larger than yourself. And I love that. I really do.
Yes. So with learning, you know, how to write screenplays and coming up with your process, like what steps did you take to learn how to write? I mean, you said that you took a class, but was there anything else that you did, like on your own? Did you research on the internet? Did you buy books, or you know?
Yeah, I bought a lot of books. You know, I sort of, my deal with my office, I have a little office in the house, and my rule is that my goal is to sort of assimilate, find stuff I like, I keep it on the shelf, I look at it, and then when I'm done with it, I get rid of it and move on. So
okay.
I would. From what I remember, I mean, I started with, screenplay, writing the picture. That was one of my favorite books. Obviously, Robert McKee. Everybody starts with Robert McKee. and I actually went, my biggest, moment in the very beginning was I went down to Atlanta to the Robert McKee seminar.
And cool.
That was great. He was very complex. I find I use a lot of his stuff, but he was so complex. But the best moment of the whole thing was that he got really mad because people had pagers and cell phones going off.
Huh.
And so he said, the next person whose cell phone goes off has to pay me, I think it was $20 or something like that. And not 5 seconds later, this guy in a suit, his phone went
uh-huh.
off. And McKee made him put his phone up on the desk and made him pay him $20. It was awesome.
Oh, really?
It was so cool. So, yeah, I went to that seminar. I read a lot of books. I did, you know, a couple of online courses because, again, it was during that phase I was looking for process, and I was trying to see if somebody had a process. I knew no one's process would fit me perfectly, but I was trying to find one I could kind of adapt. And I ended up in a place that was very reputable. A lot of people use it, so I never give the name. They messed me up so much.
Oh, yeah, I got you.
God, so I lost, I mean, at least a year. It was a disaster. It's too bad. It was a great story idea, but I'll never go back to it.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of, you have to learn that, you know what I mean? Like, it's okay, even though you're not a paid screenwriter, you
uh-huh.
know yourself and your voice better than anyone. So at some point, you have to stop and say, I don't necessarily hold with what you're saying. I'm going to go with what I'm saying. And I think a lot of writers can't do that. They have trouble.
Uh-huh.
And you have to. You just have to do it. You have to start defining your lines in the sand for what you're going to write. And that's, I think, the beginning to finding your voice.
Yes. I definitely would agree. I mean, I think a lot of writers, like you said, are looking for a process that fits them. And some try to follow it to the T, you know.
Right.
And you can't do that. I mean, myself, I pull from everywhere. You know, somebody will say something, I'll analyze it, I'll absorb it, I'll analyze it. Does that make sense to me? I'll put it up to a test. You know what? That does make sense. Okay, I can follow that. I can follow that rule because that makes sense to me, you know.
Yeah.
But something else somebody else might say is like, that sounds more like an opinion, you know what I mean?
Right.
And not necessarily a fact. You know, so I mean, my process is just an amalgamation of, you know, hundreds of things I've learned just, you know, throughout trying to learn how to write, you know.
Yeah.
But I think a lot of people try and stick, like they get a book and it says, well, in the book it says to do this, so that's what I'm going to do, you know. And it's like, it's great if it works for you, but what if it doesn't work? Then what are you going to do, you know?
Right.
And then sometimes I feel you have to modify it or tweak it a bit to fit you and your style of writing.
Right. Yeah, I think one of the greatest things, Liza Javi Jessup, who's been a really great supporter of mine, and she was with Script Shark, and now she's at Baseline, and she said to me, no one's really buying scripts. What they're doing is they're buying the writer's voice. They want to know, are you going to be a pain in the butt? Are you somebody I can work with? Can you generate ideas? And so in that respect, your script is really just a tool. It's like your welcome basket, you know, and so you need to make sure you don't sound like everybody else. You want to give them what they want, but do it in your Kelly way. And I've held on to that, and it's worked so far for me.
You spoke about a story called Bad Girls. What's that about?
Bad Girls started out, it's a thriller. It has a female lead, and that was actually my challenge when I wrote the novel. I wanted to write something with a female lead. And it's a story of a woman who's just been released from a Massachusetts sanitarium, essentially, and she's kind of on her own and, you know, trying to figure out how she ended up there, spending the last 5 years there, and her husband was murdered, and so she puts the pieces together. It all takes place in a bus station.
Cool.
So actually, I am adapting it into a play because it's pretty much one set, and they're all pretty much fixed, and in the end, there's, you know, a twisting reveal that's, you know, a lot like Sixth Sense or The Usual Suspects along those lines.
So what? Why a bus station? Just wondering.
What?
Why did you pick up the bus? You said she's just getting out, and so is it she's just getting out, so she's at the bus station? Is that why it takes place in the bus station?
Well, they, yeah, in terms of the story, they essentially just, because we actually had a story in the newspaper about 10 years ago where budget cuts, and we had to sort of take the people who weren't too bad and let them go. And they, one hospital just sort of walked them all to the bus station and gave them 20 bucks and put them on a bus. And
wow,
we were all
okay.
kind of upset about that. So that was sort of the kernel of the story of what would it be like and who would be one of these people. But I left it, they get on the bus and it's their last stop for the night, and there's a snowstorm and they're actually snowed in at the Peter Pan bus station. And I like it because I love settings that obviously have more than one meaning. And I mean, a bus station is a place where you're meeting people, you're also maybe going somewhere, coming from somewhere. It's also, for a lot of people, in a way, a dead end. They're never really the nicest places, kind of thing. And they're also very minimal in terms of setting. So there's not a lot. There's maybe a candy machine, there's, you know, a bathroom, hard seats. Yeah, it's kind of a neat, you can't really get comfortable in a bus station, and I think that's why it appeals.
Definitely not, yeah. Oh, that's cool, that's cool. So what sparked that story idea?
I don't really know, actually. That was one of those weird ones that I just sort of woke up. I remember reading the news story and then thinking, you know, I don't know, what would her story be? And thinking of kind of the worst thing that would happen. And at the time, I had someone in my life, just an acquaintance, who I just thought was the most awful human being I'd ever met. And so I actually, you know, sort of made her the bad person, and it worked really, really well.
That's funny. So so you said so how was the stage play coming along? How was the adaptation coming along?
Really, really well, actually, because, again, that was yet another challenge. I really didn't know how to write plays. So one of the things I did is I went off. I've learned to go and get a mentor when I'm entering something. So before I start working, I sort of vet the project myself. Is this really going to work? I read all the screenwriting books and playwriting books. I read a lot of plays.
Yeah.
And then I went off and started networking, and I found, you know, a playwright, a couple of them, actually, who are very, very accomplished. One of them is an award-winning playwright, and said, hey, would you be willing to answer questions?
Great.
And it's amazing. I mean, when you come in with the right attitude, when you come in with, you know, a very grateful attitude, it's amazing. People want to share their knowledge. It's been fantastic. So I wish I knew that 10 years ago.
Right. Would have made some things a whole lot easier, huh?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, all those late nights with the sorbet in the office going, why?
So, bad girls. Okay, that sounds really interesting. I really like the way you have it set up in the bus station. I mean, it sounds definitely like something that I would like to see. You have another one, Batches of Bill, a short film.
Yeah, Batches of Bill. Okay, so this was interesting because it was around the time, now I had my process, and now I was starting to think about how do you get out there, because I'm in the wilds of Massachusetts. I've never been to Hollywood. I don't know how any of this works.
Yeah.
So I was reading screenwriting magazines, and they talked about how, well, every screenwriter has to have a short film produced. So, okay, I'll go do that. So I had written Batches of Bill. I know, I'd written Batches of Bill as just a short story. And it's the story, I really wanted to see how far would you go? Kind of an insecure person who really thought they loved their spouse and their spouse dies. How far would you go to not let go of that, to try to keep your life static the way it is? So from that came Nora, who is she's very controlling in-laws. Her husband, Bill, who did everything for herself, he's died, and she just can't handle it. And her in-laws are controlling the funeral. And so one night she steals his ashes and goes up to their fishing cabin. And, she, of course, she's never been there. It's his man place, so there are all kinds of surprises up there waiting for her.
Wow,
And she drinks a margarita, and as she's talking to Bill, she decides to drink Bill. So she tosses him in the margarita and consumes his ashes. And so it was really fun to write. And so I actually have two versions of it. I have one where I wrote both of them as short scripts. So, and the first one was kind of a supernatural where, because she consumes the ashes, she now starts to get visuals of what Bill was really like.
Oh, okay.
She has to come to terms with who Bill really was, and, you know, who that makes her and all that. The second version was the version that actually placed in American Gem, the short screenplay competition. And that one is more straight. It's a more straight comedy. She does this thing, but in the meantime, her meddling mother shows up. And, of course, the next day she has to have the, what do you call it, when they cast the ashes into the sea ceremony, and she has no ashes. So that funeral is probably one of my favorite things I've ever written, that funeral scene. It's just absolutely my favorite.
So the straight version, like you said, that's the one that you're going to do the short film on?
You know, I decided not to do the short film because, again, that was like another chapter of my life. And then I moved into the next chapter of my career where I went out to L.A. last January and had my first round of meetings. And I had a producer, an incredible producer, this woman who basically, you know, the movie Neverland with Johnny Depp.
Yes.
Okay, she discovered it as a stage play, and she nurtured it and brought it forward, and it's because of her that we got to see it on the screen, she and her partner.
Great.
And I said to her, so, do you think that I have to have a short film? And she looked me right in the eye, and she said, absolutely not, writer's right. If you want to be a filmmaker, be a filmmaker, but if you want to be a writer, be a writer. I don't want to be a filmmaker. I want to be a writer. That's what I want to do. So, you know, I want to get the kid ready for school and send them off to the bus, and then, you know, I hope they make their way, but that's
my job is done.
Yeah, I don't want to go to school with them. I don't care how their lunch was. Just go, because I have more kids at home that I want to send
off.
Yeah, so I was very happy that, you know, it placed in that. Actually, I was totally surprised it placed in that contest because I didn't find out till about 9 months later. I had no idea. But, yeah, I mean, that's how I feel. I'm really comfortable. I love learning things. I don't want to be a producer. I don't want to do any of that. I just want to write.
Wow, that's great. That's great because, you know, a lot of people nowadays, you know, they want to wear the multiple hats, writer, director, or actor, writer, director, producer, or, you know.
Yeah.
But it's cool to where you just want to write. That's great.
I admire that, people who do that. I mean, I follow these people on Twitter, and I talk to them, and I just think, how do you handle all this? Because I just have no desire. You know what it is? I can't even see the film that way, Jamal. I don't, you know, you talk to some people, and they see the words on the page as a writer, but then they also start to see it as a producer. They're thinking budget things and settings, and I just don't. I just see the story on the page. That's it.
So how has like going to LA and meeting producers and such, how has that affected you? How has that, well, I don't want to say changed your life, but how has it changed your life?
Well, I had a tremendous nervous breakdown. I came home from that trip. I mean, it was just a blow your mind, awesome, just amazing trip. And I came home, and really didn't know what to do. I was kind of shell-shocked because I was in meetings, and I was really learning the art of the meeting. I didn't expect to come home and have an agent or have sold anything. I was going – it was really like recon. I was going to learn how you do this. So I came home. I was exhausted. And at the last meeting, we were talking, and the agent I was meeting with said, well, I really like your voice, but I don't – think I really heard your voice in Master's Key. And I thought, what are you talking about? And he said, I really would love to see you do something for TV, which I didn't know that screenwriters wrote TV and vice versa. I had no idea. So that was another big lesson that, you know, hey, agents, especially boutique agents, they like, if you're going to be a comedy writer, they want you to do comedy in all different medias because that gives them more bang for their buck, essentially.
Exactly.
So I came home and I thought, okay, he liked my TV idea. Right off the head, I just, you know, he said, do you have any TV ideas? I said, sure. I never intended to show it to anyone. But I pitch it, and he says, I'd like to see it. Okay, I hadn't written it yet, Jamal. So I was like, let me get back to you on that.
Exactly.
And I came home and started learning TV writing as fast as I could. And I really sort of, you know, spent the spring doing that, trying to get a pilot ready. But that was a big learning that, hey, you're not done learning it. You have to learn all of this. You got to do plays and you have to do TV and you have to do film. And so that was really interesting to me. Yeah.
That's
great. Was the spring.
So, so from when you started to learn screenwriting to the point to where like you know, your scripts have, you know, won awards and such and place in competitions, like how what was the length of time in between those 2 points? Like how long did it take you to start to the point that you are now?
Oh, well, let's see. I would say, well, the first thing that I ever entered a contest, that was Bad Girls, and that placed in the Cinesure, like, quarterfinals or something. But that was my first thing. So that was 2003, so I used that as a landmark. So that was
kind of
the first. So I'd say I was probably, you know, fiddling around with screenwriting for about 3 years before that, before I got really serious. Uh-huh.
So you mentioned Master's Key.
Yeah.
What is that about?
Master's Key came to me. I was having a Christmas party, and one of my dear friends has a son, a teenage son, who has Asperger's. And
okay.
We were chatting, and it occurred to me that I actually know four boys about the same age, all with Asperger's, and they're just the coolest. Yeah, and they're the coolest guys. You know, they have different levels of, you know, Asperger's in terms of their functioning,
yes.
But they're so cool. There's, you know, there's a stereotype in movies and TV right now of people with Asperger's, and even like, what is it, Parenthood, that show on ABC, you know, that's just not the type of kid that I see on a regular basis. These kids know they have it, they're very cool about it, and they're just really unique. So we were talking, and at one point she mentioned that her son had been given this mechanical baby doll as part of the parenting course. And she didn't know what to do because she was like, my son doesn't get real people. What am I supposed to do with this stupid doll all weekend?
Yeah.
And I just thought, oh, my God. The minute she said it, this character of the teenager, and there was a cheerleader. And so it's the story of Morgan Masters, who is a high schooler who has Asperger's. He has a younger brother. His parents are divorced, and he lives with his mom. And she's very controlling, you know, very worried about him. And sort of the whole family's focused on Morgan's Asperger's. And one day, you know, he gets pushed by the principal to really sort of try to connect with people. And he gets put in the parenting course, and he's paired with the girl, the school's most popular girl, Shelley, the teenager, to take care of this, you know, smart baby doll for the weekend. And it also happens to be the weekend of Shelley's sweet 16 birthday bash. And so he, you know, it's a comedy, but I wrote it with a very specific goal in mind. I really wanted the hero to have Asperger's, but I didn't want the movie to be about Asperger's.
Yes, understood.
So it was really hard, but yeah, it's gotten a really good reception. I mean, it's been an excellent, excellent portfolio piece, that's for sure.
Oh, that's great. So now, have you kind of like always written comedy, or is it something that you is it something that you started doing once you got older, or have you kind of always written it since you were younger?
I've just always written comedy, and it's kind of funny you ask that, because somebody sent me not too long ago, an ex-boyfriend from high school sent me a packet of all the notes that I had written him in high school, you know, like during class. And
yes.
Some of them have like stories where I don't even remember writing them. And he kind of tied them all together with shoelaces, and he sent it to me, and it was hilarious. So
cool.
I guess I was doing it even earlier than I thought I was. I thought I started in college, but I clearly started in high school.
I mean, I would love to write comedy, but I don't necessarily think that what I find funny, somebody else may find funny.
Yeah.
Do you feel that the things that you write that you feel are funny, do you think that, that other people will find this funny? You know what I mean? Or is it like, I hope they like it?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I think if you read the tweets that I put out there.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
To me, that's really, I really use Twitter for networking, but it's also kind of like my stand-up stage. It's where I sort of test things and see who responds to them. And yeah, I never really worry about if people think it's funny. I think because, you know, people have been laughing at me since I was a kid. I just don't worry about it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I just don't, I don't really worry about it. I mean, that was always my way to get friends. It was also my way out of situations. You know, the one and only time I was ever bullied, I got out of it with a joke. I mean, yeah, that's always been my thing.
That's great. Yeah, that's the one genre, I think, for me that I've always been hesitant to try to tackle. I mean, normally, you know, I do science fiction, fantasy, horror, drama, action, no problem. You know what I mean? But comedy is like, I'm always kind of gun shy, you know, to attempt this. So I just wonder, you know, people who write comedy, you know, do they just naturally feel like, wow, you know, this is funny and people are going to love it? Or do they go through the same thing I go through? But do they just overcome that fear of, they might not find this funny, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't. Somebody just asked me, another writer sent me an email and asked me a question about, she wanted to write multiple genres, and her writing teacher said, don't do that, you have to write one genre. And I've had this discussion with a lot of producers and the agents I met with, and, you know, my thing is, I don't write comedy. I don't think of it that way. I just write with a comic voice.
Okay.
And I think that people are looking for a particular voice. That's really what agents and producers and directors are looking for. They're looking for a voice. And if they find it, it's going to come through no matter what you write, and they're going to like it. That's really what they're looking for. And so I think that's what you should be consistent with, is voice, not necessarily genre. I don't know that. And, I mean, I could be totally wrong. But in my experience so far, that's what I'm finding, is that people are responding to my different scripts, even though they're not in the same genre, but because they all say the same thing. Oh, it's a great voice. Yeah, it's good. Because my comedy works its way into however it works its way in. You know, I mean, even Bad Girls was technically a thriller, but there are comic moments in that fit. So, I don't know. I go with that.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's a great insight. So, from your own work, right, do you have a favorite character?
I would say Nora, the widow from Matches of Bill.
And why is she your favorite character?
Because she's just willing to do anything. I mean, she's totally blind to the truth of her situation, and she's blind to her own strength. You know, she doesn't realize how powerful she is. She's just afraid.
Uh-huh.
And by the end, she's over that. So she's done something that other people would view as really horrible and a terrible mistake, but it gets her where she needs to go. And I that's the way my life works.
That's cool. So in a sense, she somewhat reminds you of yourself?
Yeah, she does, for sure. Because my favorite, I've never actually eaten anyone, but my favorite people are the people.
I hope not.
My favorite people are the people who talk about their mistakes more than their successes, but they do it in kind of a funny way. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Somebody said to me, they sent me a funny picture when I was going to Hollywood in January, and it's a caricature of me with my bags packed, and the title is Lucille Ball Goes to Hollywood. Yep, that's about the size of it.
That's cool. So what are you working on currently?
Right now I just started, I was messing around with some scripts. I still have the pilot, and actually I came up with another TV pilot that I'm working on. So I have those two are in the process of being drafted. And my next major feature script is it's interesting. It's kind of, if you could take 12 Angry Men and cross it with Red. So it's a female lead, and you know, it's a courtroom sort of movie, but there's a twist to it that kind of kicks it into more of the thriller. So it's fun. It allows me to write some action scenes, and it allows me to still indulge in my humor, which is where I get the Red aspect. But it's there's still a thriller puzzle in there as she tries to figure out the main character. Why her? Why is she in this situation? And so that's really fun. That I have to have that done this week so I can send it to the story, because that will be my CineStory script that goes out there for them. So.
Okay. So what are you still like on the first draft, or is this like a second draft? Or
This is still first draft. I'm going through and adding some new scenes I came up with. And so, but they said, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. They'll even take just a treatment. They just want to be able to talk to you about your writing when you get out there. So they have Master's Key, and I'm going to bring this out as a second example. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to picking their brains. I can't wait.
I'm sure. Wow, that's great. That's great. So who or what inspires you to write these stories? Is there anything in particular, person, a particular thing?
You know, the stories themselves, I just love to be creative, and I love to take two unlike things and see what happens and you put them together. My brain, I really do treat my brain like a laboratory and in that way. In order to do this every day, though, I always think of my Nana because we lost her about 2 years ago, and she had, 11 kids, 8 surviving. She had she was a military wife, and her dream was always to be an animator at Disney.
Wow.
I know, and she never got to go, but I have some of her hand pencil sketches she would do on the back of her grocery receipts, and they're really dear to me. And so every day when I get up and I think, oh, I don't want to do this today, I think Lydia would do it. And so, kind of doing it for Lydia is what I'm doing.
Oh, that's great. That's great. That's really honorable there. So as a writer, is there anything in particular that you're trying to say to the world? Like, are there any particular themes that you happen to find that are constant in your writing? Like any type of messages or,
Yeah, I'd probably say that my whole thing to mankind is to get the hell off your high horse is probably my message. That's my thing is always I like to have characters that most people would view as broken or abnormal. And
okay.
I don't like to write the traditional movie where, they overcome it or it gets fixed or whatever. I want them to be just as broken, but I want them to have found a way to make their place in the world. I think that's okay. I think it's okay for us to be broken. Yeah, I'm cool with that.
Okay, so a not so happy ending?
Yeah, it's not the ending you expect. It can still be happy, but it's not, the perfect she got the nose job or, whatever.
And the world is better now.
Yeah, like Avatar. Avatar, don't get me started on Avatar. That drives me crazy. It was a great movie. I know. But let's face it, we started off okay with a guy who's disabled, but by the end of the movie, he doesn't accept his disability. He gets rid of it. He leaves it behind. Bugs me.
He gets
that
a whole
ending,
new life.
Yeah, he does, and he gets to become this blue person who doesn't even have a zit. I mean, he's perfect as a blue person. It drives me crazy. Drives me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah, and also, he also kind of just inherits leadership, He's like,
right, yeah.
I'm the leader now.
Right, he gets to go be the blue president. I mean, what is that all about?
He's like, that's really convenient. That's some luck right there.
Exactly.
Wow. I mean, if you think about it, like, who, in a sense, wouldn't want that? Okay, here you have your real life to where you have nobody, you have no one, you have no family, you're crippled, you're broken, and then by the end of it, you're in a fresh new body, you have a beautiful girl, you're the leader of these people. It's like,
exactly.
Wow.
Yes,
that was really great.
But see, no, when I have this discussion with people, people who don't write movies,
yes.
they don't
yes.
get it. I mean, you get it, but they don't. They just look at me and go, yeah, but it was all about peace. No, it wasn't. It wasn't all about peace. What are you talking about?
No,
yeah, it's not really funny. It's funny.
Yeah,
but that's my thing.
To me, the funniest thing about that that film was the name of the thing that they were after. The unobtainium.
Oh,
they're like, seriously?
Yeah.
Seriously?
Yeah.
I'm like, wait, is this the Cartoon Network? I mean, seriously, unobtainium?
Jamal, I totally forgot about that.
It's like, you couldn't think of anything better than that. I mean, and it's like, it's so right there in your face of what the message is. It's trying to get something that's unobtainable. I get it, but you're going to call it unobtainium? Seriously?
That is, I forgot about that.
And see, when I saw it, I was like, now, granted, whoever, who wrote it, I'm just saying, okay. But nobody said, hey, dude, can you come up with a better name? I mean, everything else is great, but this name, it went through so many checks and balances, and that name survived. I don't get that.
It's the very definition of on-the-nose dialogue.
Yeah, it's like, wow. When he said, I looked at my wife like, did you just call it unobtainium? Seriously?
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I was like, wow, okay, that's okay. Wow. Okay. So we were talking about things that inspire you. So I know that on your blog, you said that you would love to write for Drew Barrymore.
I would, yeah.
And why?
Yes. She, I just think she has a great perspective. I've read a lot of her interviews when she's, you know, serious, not People magazine, but, you know, when she is Fade In magazine and when she has these serious interviews talking about film. And I think she's not on a high horse is the thing. You know, she really, she likes flawed people. All of her characters are so flawed and they don't all get fixed in the end. And I think that I share that perspective. I saw a quote once where she talked about herself as a person and she doesn't fit in with Hollywood. And she said, you know, no matter what they do, I'll always be a little bit of Jell-O tacked to a pole. And I thought that was just the most hilarious thing I'd ever heard, and so unassuming, and it was just really, I think she has a great attitude, again, that not everyone has to be fixed, and I just really like that. I like her films. They're simple, they're sweet. I think they're great.
Well, yeah, one film of hers that I didn't think I'd like, just from the previews, I was like, yeah, okay, whatever, and didn't grab me, but as usual, I caught her on cable, sat down, watched, like, oh, I really liked it, was Whip It. That she directed.
Yes.
I was like, that was actually kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, I'm like, wow, okay. That was cool.
We'd seen her act and do kind of these quirky, bubbly things, and she did some indies, and then that came out, and you were like, oh my God, the girl has teeth. That was unbelievable.
Exactly. Yeah. I was like, wow, okay.
Yeah, you know, I love that. I love it.
Okay, so Drew Barrymore. Okay, that's, to me, that kind of stuck out when I was just, you know, looking through your website. I mean, before, we talked about doing the interview, just, you know, when I first met you on Twitter, you know, looking through your site, like, wow, okay, Drew Barrymore. I don't really see, at least I never really seen, you know, too many people say, yeah, Drew Barrymore. You know what I mean? So I was like, not that there's anything wrong. It's like she's one of those, for me, she's one of those people who kind of like, at least float under the radar in a sense to where they're talented, but you don't hear about them everywhere. So with her, when you brought up her name, it was like, wow, okay, that's different. You know, that's kind of cool. So, outside of writing, right, what do you do in your spare time?
Well, I have one of those, you know, writer minds that doesn't turn off. So I find that I can't have idle hands. So
So there's another member of that group.
Oh, God.
I found another one.
Oh, man. The joke in my town is that they see me everywhere walking. I walk everywhere. And, I live in a little town. So, I mean, it's 2 miles from my house to the center of town where we have one store, you know, kind of thing.
Okay.
And people see me walking all over town because I'll do 4 miles in a day to clear my head in Weathersfoot. I like to garden. My big thing is probably puzzles. I mean, when I have guests come over, they know that the lumpy stuff under the tablecloth is my current puzzle, so just ignore it and be careful where you put your wine glass.
Exactly, right?
They all know that. There's always a puzzle on my dining room table because there's no other way for me to kind of put my brain in idle. I can't do it.
Yeah.
So I don't meditate. If I meditate, I start thinking about what I have to do and – Yeah, I think it's hard, and I think a lot of really good somebody on Twitter just posted Zach Sanford, I think, posted something. There was an interview with Shane Black, and I think he's a great screenwriter, and he said the same thing. You know, you just have to keep doing something, let your subconscious wind down.
Yeah, I mean, there's things that I do, but I mean, like you, I know it drives my wife crazy, but. You know, 24 hours a day, I could be watching TV, say, hey, what you think about? And I want to say the story arc, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
how this character going to get out of this situation, you know? It's like, I don't want to be evil eye, but it's like, you know, I got to fix this paragraph, you know?
Exactly. But you sit and you watch movies or you watch TV, and I find sometimes I feel really guilty, like, oh, my God, I should be up doing something. I'm sitting here. But I know my brain is soaking all of this in. It's taking it all in, and it's doing something with it. So you got to get over that thing. But, yeah, I'm lucky my daughter is reaching the age, and she is really, really smart because we've been talking about literary criticism since she was little. So I can talk to her. She's been kind of perusing at my screenwriting book, so we can have a conversation. My husband will take one look at me and be like, why don't you go get on that Twitter thing with your friends? why don't you just go away?
Right. Yes, there's definitely the different type of brain. Yeah, definitely.
Yes.
So puzzles in your spare time. What is one of your favorite books?
Favorite books?
It could be, instructional, or it could be just purely entertainment.
Yeah, I don't really think I have a favorite book. I mean, I constantly, anytime anybody suggests anything, I pick it up. So my bookshelf is really very eclectic. I read, everything. I even went through a phase a couple of years ago of reading, I'm atheist, but I read, all translations of religious texts because I was fascinated by it.
Yes.
So somehow that must be working it in. I don't know how, but when you spot it, let me know. It's got to be in there somewhere.
Right. So not necessarily any favorite books. Do you have a favorite film?
Favorite films, yes. I actually have two kinds. I have what I call brain candy, which is Blazing Saddles.
Okay.
Mel Brooks. I love Mel Brooks. I wanted to be adopted by Mel Brooks when I was a child. Yeah, Blazing Saddles I just think is awesome. Again, it's a comedy and you laugh and there are fart jokes, but he made a black guy sheriff. I mean, and he wrote that movie years ago, and that could have gone one of two ways. Audiences could have looked at that and been like, what? Or
exactly.
That was still iffy. I just love Blazing Saddles. And then a movie that really moves me all the time is On the Color Purple.
Okay.
I feel every emotion. I mean, you laugh and you cry and you get excited and you get mad and those last 5 minutes over the fields of purple, I'm a disaster.
Uh-huh.
And I've been watching that movie for how old is that movie? 20 years? it was based on a book, but I can't imagine how they adapted that book. It's so rich. But that to me is kind of wonderful, wonderful filmmaking. So I'd like to be somewhere in the middle of those two.
Okay, so Blazing Saddles mixed with The Color Purple.
There you go.
Wow. I can't wait for you to write that one. I just love to see how it turns out. So, music, any particular favorite song that you like?
One of my favorite songwriters, because I like real songwriters, real musicians. I don't like manufactured people. Billy Joel.
Yes.
I think one of my favorites he ever did was that Scenes from an Italian Restaurant. I love the change up, and I mean, you really feel like you're having a conversation, and it's a song, and then all of a sudden he's waxing rhapsodic about the days of high school, and I just think that's really cool. I mean, think of all the stuff he fits into that one song.
Yeah.
And it's like a whole relationship. He catches up with the girl, and then at the end they say goodbye. But they've had this rich sort of moment. I just think that's awesome. That's my favorite song ever.
Great. So outside of your work, outside of what you write, do you have a favorite hero character?
In terms of
film or books, not like a real person.
Yeah, I probably don't have a favorite hero. I have a very weird favorite villain, though.
Oh, okay. Well, that was the next question. So this could tell us a lot about you. So who's your favorite villain?
Jamal, this is going to tell you a lot about me. So my favorite all-time villain is the alien from the first Aliens movie.
Oh, okay. No, I'm okay. I can dig that.
I love it because I think that it's just a really coolly conceived creature, and it has a very specific goal, which is to survive. But what's so cool about it is, and it'll do anything to survive, but what's so cool is you see that creature go from birth all the way through maturation. And I mean, name another movie where you get to see that with your villain or even, your hero. Where you don't even really notice it because you're so focused, you're buying into the people, but think about what the alien is going through. I mean,
Right, that poor guy.
These
people after him.
There's no mother. There's no...
She's just trying to live.
What a horrible life. Yeah, I mean, yeah, that's where my empathy gene is just, like, way into overdrive. But, yeah, I really like the first Alien. I just thought that was really a cool concept, and the fact that it's born and it's just you've got human beings and this weird creature all acting on instinct because nobody taught this thing what to do. It's just kind of winging it, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah, I thought it was very, very cool, and I was actually a little sad when it died at the end.
Yeah, the alien creature, yeah, that's one of my top five favorite aliens, and really one of the main aspects I like about it is how it can adapt in terms of how, depending on what depending on what it's birthed from, it takes on that creature's basic form or shape, you know,
yeah.
Like. And when it was in a human, it came out humanoid looking. And then I think in part three, I think the one when Ripley wound up on that prison planet, and a facehugger got hold of a dog, and then it came out in the form of a dog, kind of.
Right.
In a sense, it was called the bulldog alien.
Yep.
And so, you know, so when I seen it, I was like, wow, because I didn't realize it could do that. I just assumed it would always come out looking humanoid.
Right.
But once I saw that, it added another dimension to it. Like, wow, I wonder what it would look like if it came out of, like, a killer whale.
Right.
You know what I mean? So it just started me thinking, well, what about a giraffe alien? You know, it's like that's...
You got to pick really carefully. And in that, as a human woman, I really identify that you got to really be careful what you're mating with. Think
ahead. Exactly.
Yeah,
so,
it's really cool. It's a great creature, and it's a really great, you know, kind of concept that they have going on. I think that's why it was so successful too. And of course, the Ripley character. She was amazing.
That's one of the aspects I loved about the film. The first one was the fact that you didn't see her coming. You know, you assumed Dallas was going to be the hero, and then it just switches on you like, oh snap! it's this chick. Oh, okay. That's cool. So, yeah, that's what I liked about the film itself, was that twist right there. So, okay, the feature from from Alien, that's out of my own heart. That's great. So, you're working on the TV pilot now. So, I mean, what overall, I say, what is next for Kelly? What's, like, the next, I guess, achievement or milestone that you're aiming towards?
Well, my next milestone, I think, and I do write specific goals for my business plan, so it's to make a connection either with a producer or an agent, to really get a professional partner in Hollywood who believes in my work and my voice. And so my first step to that is to attend CineStory, the writer's retreat, in September.
Uh-huh.
And I'm going to be bringing out a couple of scripts for the week before that, so I'm lining up meetings in L.A. before that. So I'm really hoping to take things to the next level and at CineStory get a lot of questions answered and be able to set some new goals. So, but hopefully September I'm working toward really finding that connection.
That's great.
Yeah.
Somewhat going backwards, but being at the level that you are now,
yeah.
Right? Like, have other writers asked you to, like, take a look at what they're writing, at their screenplays and such?
Yeah, I've had a few people ask me. And, I'm to the group on Twitter, I'm pretty open to that if I'm talking to them. You know, if it's somebody I already, you know, they're my twit pals, I call them, and I believe in what they're doing. I never want to be the biggest fish in the little pond. I can't.
Yeah.
I just keep jumping ponds. You know what I mean? So I don't want to do. I really love being a sounding board to other people in terms of their ideas because I'm fascinated by that process. But yeah, I'm really careful about, you know, being a script reader or any of that stuff. But I do love sharing ideas with people when they bring out their scripts. Because, first of all, I know how scary that is and how much trust it requires to do that. And I'm so appreciative when people are willing to share that with me. So that's happened a few times, yeah.
So what would you say, not necessarily, what would you say, what are some of the, I guess, main, either, what are some of the main writing mistakes that you've seen or what advice would you give to, you know, people who are just starting to learn how to screenwrite? Like, what instance would you say would be kind of like the best route to go, or like what's one of the, I guess, biggest obstacles in actually writing a screenplay that you would suggest that they focus on to master?
I think that I found the greatest success in terms of momentum. I was always achieving each goal that I set. I would do whatever it takes to do that. But probably the greatest momentum came after I really found my voice. And, you know, I'd been learning the format. I found, as you and I talked about, a process that worked for me. And because I had that process, I now had breathing room to think about how I wanted to write things. What's my perspective? As opposed to studying genre, you should know your genre, but studying genre and saying, okay, so I have to put in this kind of joke here, and I have to have this
exactly.
kind of character here. That's a huge mistake, and I think a lot of people do that, and a lot of talented people, and if they could just let go of it, I think they'd be able to write some incredible stories. You do have to leave room for your perspective, because that's what they want to see. That's what they want to hear.
Yes. So in a sense, it's like, you know, learning the formula, you know, or the basic structure, the basic skeleton, but still, you know, like I said, putting your own voice to it. You don't have to be so rigid with what you're learning.
Exactly. Yeah, like when I got the notice, the very first script in the Cinesure competition, and I really didn't know anything about anything, and I got that, and my family said, oh, my God, it's so exciting. And I remember I wasn't thinking about moving on in it. I wasn't thinking about it. I was thinking, okay, I nailed the format. This means they didn't throw it out. Excellent. You know? So from there, you start to think about, you know, what's my perspective on things? I know my perspective is different than the next person's, and that's a good thing. I see that as a good thing. So, but you have to get confident with that and be comfortable, because I spent a lot of time trying to write what I thought people wanted to read, and that is a rabbit hole you can't get out of. It's really, it's hard. It's, and a lot of people are very, oh, that's another thing, defensive. I mean, sometimes I can smell it on somebody. I got to be kind of careful about, you know, when I give feedback. You know, you don't want to shatter dreams, but at the same time, they're doing that because they're scared. They're afraid to kind of break out, and you just have to. You know, this is your, either, just write it for yourself, and then if other people want to share it, it's fantastic, but just write it.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I definitely follow that in terms of writing for myself. I mean, I know a lot of people, be it, you know, other screenwriters or even published authors, say, well, you know, you got to write to sell, which is, okay, yeah, great. That's ultimately what you want to do. But for me, it's like, well, if I don't like the story, I can't write it. So I have to write something that I like.
Exactly.
You know what I mean? In order to do my best, you know, it's just I guess an argument that I come across every now and then, is writing for yourself or writing for your readers, you know, and it's like, well, you're kind of doing the same. You're doing both, because I mean, if you're writing something and you're, wow, this is really good, you obviously think that the readers are gonna like it as well. You know,
right.
So I'm like, well, what do you mean write for the, you know what I mean? I've never understood, you know, what do you mean write for the reader? What does that mean?
Yeah, I
know
exactly what you mean. Yeah, but I tend to look at it as maybe a more optimistic view than what those types of people are putting out there, which is, look, you have to be born with an innate skill, an innate talent to write and to convey ideas, okay? That can't be helped. So let's say you have that, we check it off. The next thing is, you just have to start to look at yourself objectively. What are my weaknesses as a writer? Where do I need to work? Where do I need to study? If you're doing all that work behind the scenes, then when you sit down to write, you're automatically going to be writing stuff people want. It's just the way it is. You know, Master's Key might not be everybody's cup of tea. Why? Because Hollywood's still afraid to have a hero with Asperger's. I know. I hear this at every meeting. But they want the next thing. They want to see the next thing. I wrote a very quirky comedy, but it got them to want the next thing. And that's all you keep in mind. I was true to myself, and now they want more of it. And so now I just have to figure out what idea they're going to click in with. But that's hard. It's really scary. I know that. I know how scary that is.
It is. I think one of the things I try to tell people, and one of the things that I have to come to grips myself with, is that, because I wrote a post about it, and the title of it is You Suck and You Always Will.
I saw that one.
and it's like, you know, basically saying, no matter what you do, you're always going to fuck to somebody, no matter what you do.
Right.
So you might as well just write it, because no matter what, not everybody is going to like it. So if you're trying to write to get everyone's approval, yeah, you're gonna drive it so crazy.
Yeah.
You know, go ahead.
Do you read, like, script magazines?
Yes.
Okay. See, now I don't even read them. And I'm always curious to see if people read them, like, am I missing out? But I read them for a while, found that they were actually more, you know, it was kind of like reading Teen Beat or something and feeling like, you know, I needed to lose weight or something. So
even if you go back to Avatar, some people love it. Love it. Yeah. Oh, my God, that's my favorite movie. Oh, that inspired me to write. You know what I mean?
Yep.
If somebody else would be like, that was the worst movie ever.
know.
You know? So it's like, okay, so you look at who made the film, and they're a pretty big heavy hitter, and even that person has somebody that hates them. You know
right.
what I mean? So regardless, you're always going to suck somebody. So just accept it and move on. You're always going to suck.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
so,
you take confidence from it. Even Jon Favreau is having that moment. Here's a guy who has an incredibly talented career.
And everybody
is just saying he's all over. And I'm like, yeah, but I thought the movie was kind of a good idea.
Exactly. And one of the examples I use, you know, not that I know personally, but it's like you take somebody, say, like Prince, right, who a lot of people, oh, my God, he's a great musician, right? It's like, do you really think he worries about if people like his songs or not? Or do you think he just writes and makes music that he feels?
Right.
You know what I mean? And he puts it out, and what do you know? Thousands of people love it. You know what I mean? So I kind of think you have to attack it like that. Just write what you feel, write what you know, and put it out there. Because the only thing that's guaranteed is that some people going to like it, some people going to hate it. That's only guaranteed. You know? So it's like, stop worrying about it.
It's totally true, yeah.
So, Kelly, how can our listeners keep track of you?
Well, I have the website, which is kellyanalons.com, and that's where I pretty much just, you know, write. I don't blog often because my deal is that I always want to have made a specific step in my career path to then blog about. But it's usually pretty funny because I put my mistakes there too. and then on Twitter, I'm at Kelly Analons on Twitter. So.
Okay, great. So yeah, for all of you who are listening, you know, please check this woman out. She is very funny, very, very talented. As you can see, very personable, very cool woman. And thanks for tuning in.